Coming up next on Tech News Weekly, it's me, Jason Howell, my co-host, Micah Sargent, and we start off with Chloe Hsiung from Vice, who talks all about AI art. We talk about AI art on this show all the time, but what about the images behind the art that are fed into the system, those data sets? We talk all about those, where those are sourced, and some other topics related to that. Also, Aisha Counts from Protocol joins Micah to talk a little bit about Salesforce and Dreamforce and catch you up on the latest there. My story of the week is Google killing Stadia, and I wish I could say that I wasn't that I was totally surprised, but I was not at all. So we talk all about that. And then finally, Micah details the Fast Company hacker and that reprehensible Apple News notification that you may have got on your iPhone. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 254, recorded Thursday, September 29th, 2022. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Unify Meeting from MIMO Monitors. Unify simplifies your work life by combining your favorite video conferencing solutions into one reliable, universal user interface. Visit unifymeeting.com and enter code TNW for 25% off of a year's subscription, or use the same code to get 25% off any of MIMO's 7-inch displays.
And by Dell, Client Solutions Devices, orchestrated by the experts at CDW, which deliver a more personalized user experience with adaptive AI-based software that boosts collaboration wherever your team works. Learn more at cdw.com/Dell Client.
And by Blue Land. Blue Land is on a mission to eliminate single-use plastics by reinventing home essentials that are good for you and the planet. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order when you go to blueland.com/TNW.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am one of your hosts, Micah Sargent.
I'm the other guy from the corner of my bedroom, Jason Howell.
Hello, Jason. How's it going?
It's going all right. You know, we had the carpets cleaned here, and so I had to move all this stuff. So this morning, it was like putting it back into place. So if things look I realize it's just a corner, but if things look a little different, that's why I had to like repiece it all together. And you never know what you're going to get when you do that.
Up since 4 a.m. working on it.
That's right. You can see it in my eyes. Let's jump in. We talk a lot about AI on this show. And so when I came across a couple of stories here on Vice, I thought, this would make a really great interview. AI tools, creativity, all this stuff, are things that we've talked about a number of times behind that magic that is created. There's DALL-E, there's Stable Diffusion. Behind all of that are data sets that were fed into them in order to train them to do the things that they do, those cool things that they do. And what we see is the result of all that data that was fed into them. So that's kind of the groundwork. Where does consent come into play when someone's image is used in the data set? Where are these images even being pulled from? I think it's a fascinating topic, and we're going to dive into this with the author of a couple of really great stories on Vice right now, Chloe Hsiung. Welcome to the show, Chloe. It's great to have you on.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, love getting the folks from Vice on this mm-hmm. show. I feel like you guys do some really high quality work, so it's always a privilege and an honor to talk to y'all. So let's talk a little bit about first how these data sets are sourced, because we're so used to seeing the outcome, and that's the thing that really gets people kind of tantalized and kind of like, wow, this is really amazing stuff. Rarely do we then take a look at like how it's being created, and it's a really important thing to do that. So first of all, talk a little bit about how these images for these data sets are generally found and fed into a system like this.
Yeah, so AI developers take images from these data sets to train their algorithms. And where these images come from in these data sets are actually all over the internet. They take images from across the internet. For example, the data set that I specifically kind of investigated called Leon 5B, it consists of over 5 billion images. and they used a data repository called Common Crawl, which scrapes data from over 50 billion web pages, and that's where they got the images from.
So web pages, part of this is like the open web. Like I could go on a Google image search and I could do a search and find a million different, you know, faces of people I don't know. And it's all publicly available. It's right there. Then there are other sites where things are kind of locked down a little bit more. I guess Facebook kind of comes to mind. Not that you can't get to some of that stuff without logging in for an account, but there's a lot of data to be pulled from there as Facebook and Meta knows very well. Is this information source coming from places like that, or it's all pretty much just openly accessible and easy to find on the web?
So yeah, it's all any open source kind of web pages that are easily accessible. But this also means that the images might not necessarily be, you know, allowed to be taken or allowed to be reproduced under copyright. But these kind of data repositories don't really, you know, have a filter for that or take that into consideration. They just scrape any images that have alt text pairings with them and then combine the images and the text for the data sets.
Wow. Yeah. And I mean, you know, someone in our chat room, Eric Duckman, said, do they also scrape for copyright and license information? Like you said, the systems aren't necessarily set up to do that. But even if they were, is that information commonly tied to these images? Would there be a way for a scraper to recognize, oh, wait a minute, this is a copyrighted image, or this is an image that the creator of it or the subject of it doesn't actually want to end up in these systems? Like, would there even be a way for me as a person with an image on the web to say, I don't want that image to end up in that system?
Mm-hmm. So the images themselves don't have any way of telling, you know, an algorithm or a data scraper that, you know, this image is copyrighted, which makes it very hard for people to even know that their images are being used. It's only because of tools lately, such as this website that I use called Have I Been Trained, that people have been discovering their own images are being used to train AI. And that kind of just shows the ethics behind AI is this very murky area, because, you know, people don't necessarily have the tools to see or even have a say in whether or not their images are being used.
Right, right. Yeah. HaveIBeenTrained.com is the site that you're talking about. Fascinating site. Exactly. Of course, I went there and I did my vanity search. I did not find my face in the, you know, the stacks of images that came back. Although I will say I did find our podcast art, Mike, our old podcast art for this podcast in there. So that's in there. But anyways, I did, you know, go nuts with that, I suppose. AI. But you wrote specifically about someone who had a series of, at least my understanding, a series of medical images from years ago that they were under the impression were, you know, private images, and yet they found those images. Did they find those images using this tool, HaveIBeenTrained.com?
Yeah, exactly. So someone found their images that they did not consent to be spread anywhere. They only allowed their doctor to kind of take these images of them in a medical setting, and they found these images in the data set. It happens a lot where doctors and researchers will take pictures of their patients. But where these photos end up is something that kind of has been under the spotlight lately with this, you know, this new tool, because a lot of people are discovering that even if they don't give consent for these images to be distributed, they still end up being distributed. And I was speaking to a doctor named Zach Marshall, and he was saying that it might be because, you know, AI is so new. There's no way, or there's no stipulation in consent forms that are saying, you know, this image can't be used for AI purposes and this image can't be, you know, further manipulated in that way. There's only stipulations such as like this, can this image be used in a medical journal? And, you know, if that medical journal is being published online, anyone can really pick up that image, even if it's not within their permission to. And then these data scrapers will eventually find these images and then include them in the data set.
Yeah, it really seems like a something that's really hard to put the genie back in the bottle at this point. However many years the internet's been around collecting images, you know, that are indexed in all sorts of places. I mean, it's just an insane, and I feel like even that's putting it lightly, an insane trove of images out there that would be impossible to go through one by one and say, yes, this, no, not that one. I mean, without an AI that's smart enough to know, surely someone's working on that if they haven't already. Does a person who finds, so this person found their medical images in this database, does that person or anyone who finds something in this database that they don't want to be a part of, do they have any sort of recourse for removal, any way that they can prevent it even from happening? Or is it just kind of like, you know what, right now it's the Wild West and I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it's very complicated depending on kind of who owns the original image. I think that, you know, for most people, it's very difficult for them to get their images removed because they don't necessarily have copyright protection, especially if someone is the subject of the image. The copyright protection doesn't apply to the person who's in the image, but the person who, you know, took the image or the journal that published the image. So it becomes very difficult for an individual to say, you know, can I get this removed? Because there's really nothing legally that binds them to it. And in fact, I think there's more laws that protect the data set creators themselves. For example, fair use allows people to use images without permission and to use images freely. And if it qualifies under certain factors, such as, you know, educational purposes, or if the image is transformed enough. So I think things like fair use protect more so the data set creators than individuals who might have their privacy exposed. But for European citizens, actually, the data set says that if your image and your likeness is being used and the alt text corresponds to that image correctly, you have the right to kind of get that image removed under a European privacy law called GDPR. And whereas in America, we still don't really have privacy laws like that that would protect the individual.
Wow. So there it's a matter of with that metadata attached to it, it's no longer like this anonymous image of random person from the world. It is, here's an image of Chloe, or here's an image of Micah. And we know that because it's attached to the metadata. Now it's actionable to some degree, and only in the EU because they're the ones with the GDPR.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting. You also wrote another article about violent imagery being found in this database, also non-consensual pornography found in as part of the data set behind us, you know, driving Stable Diffusion. What has been the response by those who manage the data set for things like that? I mean, is it even possible to keep everything of a certain category, like those two things I named, out of the data set? What are they doing to prevent that?
Yeah. So at Motherboard, when we were using Have I Been Trained, we were quickly able to find really graphic and sexual imagery, as you mentioned. So we found ISIS execution images, and we also found non-consensual nudes that were hacked from celebrities. And we contacted everyone, kind of both developers of the AI system and the data set creators. And the data set creators kind of, you know, pushed aside their responsibility in this, saying that, you know, we don't own any of these images. We simply took images from the internet, and it's already out there. So it's not like we did anything ourselves. And I think this is kind of an argument that a lot of developers have been using, and saying, like, you know, from a developer perspective, more data is better and more data informs the algorithm. But this also means that, you know, there's a lot of questionable ethics, and does more data mean better if it's, you know, non-consensual pornography or violent imagery that is taken out of context? And there are ways to filter out these images using this filter that the data set creators had. So we've been in contact with a lot of developers, such as of Meta and of Google's Imogen, who said that they used this filter when training their AI that kind of parsed out any non-safer work and violent imagery.
Fascinating. Well, this is clearly something that's going to require a lot of work to really get, you know, under the hood and understand exactly how to do this ethically. You know, you mentioned fair use and and just usage rights in general. It really does. I think through reading your articles, it illuminated for me the opposite side of the fun of these things, which is that there are oftentimes images in there that people do not consent from. I also am reminded of this one image, and I did not link to it, but it's this, there's this woman figure that comes up repeatedly in like this kind of horror style imagery from a certain, and maybe you're familiar with this, but I wish I had a name for it. But there must be something within the data set that has that particular woman's likeliness or likeness in there to pull from, because it comes up consistently. And does that woman have a case that her face is being used in all of these like horrific and grotesque ways? We think that it's a computer just creating something that didn't exist before. And partially, I suppose it is, but it's derived from something real. And I have to imagine there's some similarity there. So really important stuff. And I just really appreciate you shedding light on this, Chloe. Chloe Cheung writes for Vice, vice.com. If people want to find you online and follow you there, where can they find you?
Yeah, they can find me on Instagram, Twitter, and any social media using the handle at Chloe Cheung. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it and enjoy talking with you about AI art and art generation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And we will do it again, Chloe. We'll be in touch. Yeah. Appreciate your time.
Yeah.
Take care and keep up the great work.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. All right. Coming up, a little insight into Dreamforce. Micah's got the interview with that topic next. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Unify Meeting from MIMO Monitors, the global experts in video conferencing solutions. So whether you're working in the office, whether you're remote like I am right now, kind of actually I'm more like hybrid. I'm remote now, but I go in on Tuesdays for all about Android. Unify simplifies your work life by combining your favorite video conferencing solutions, Zoom, Microsoft Teams, Google Meet, into one reliable universal user interface. Unify Meeting is your intuitive software solution. It simplifies your work life by combining all your favorite video conferencing solutions into one reliable universal interface. That's nice. That eliminates the hassle. It saves you time. It's pretty awesome stuff. We're all spending, obviously, a whole lot more time on video calls than we ever have before. And figuring out where to click on a screen or which video conferencing platform a meeting is in can really be a struggle, or all the settings that change. We're dealing with that with Zoom right before the show, in fact. Unify eliminates the frustration, taking the guesswork out. And it's reliable every time, as the buttons and the commands are always in the same place, whether you happen to use Zoom, Microsoft Teams, or Google Meet. So whether you're working full-time in the office, remotely, or hybrid, Unify keeps your video conferencing simple. It keeps it intuitive. You'll always know exactly where to go and what to press. Navigating between all your meetings easily without worrying about needing to keep track of changing video conferencing apps or changing commands, right? Always on your desktop, but never in your way. Unify Meeting displays your calendar at all times. That actually makes it simple to see daily schedules, upcoming meetings, and how that ties into your meeting. Then when it's time for a meeting, you simply tap the calendar invite and the app opens the video conference call in its standardized UI format. No more needing to manually open up your video conferencing software, or even really, you don't even need to know which one your meeting is actually in. Unify works best on a second or a third display. It takes up minimal desk real estate, but still provides you with enhanced convenience for added accessibility. In fact, you can still see the video conferencing application's original UI on the primary screen. So really, you get the best of both worlds as a result. Unify runs on Windows. It's PC compatible. It only costs $35.88 for the entire year. And with a purchase of any MIMO monitors display, it's free. So try Unify for your team at work, or try it for yourself. Visit UnifyMeeting.com. That's unifymeeting.com, unifymeeting.com, and enter code TNW for 25% off a year's subscription. Or you can use the same code and you'll get 25% off any of MIMO's 7-inch displays. Not bad. Simplify with Unify. And we thank Unify Meeting for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right, Micah, over to you.
So Dreamforce, yes, the impressive conference that hasn't taken place quite the same way in a few years, is back at it again this year. Joining us from Protocol to talk about it is the enterprise expert, Aisha Counts. Welcome to the show, Aisha.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So let's kick things off. Of course, before we can get into Dreamforce, we need to start with the definition for folks who might not know what in the world is Dreamforce.
Yeah, it's funny because if you were to look at the pictures and sort of see the way that it's covered, you would have no idea that it is the annual conference for Salesforce, which is an enterprise software company and a customer relationship manager builder. And so you would have no idea when you see the fuzzy creatures and sort of the Disney-esque atmosphere of it. But they do it every year. It brings people across tech, analysts, investors, and it's sort of a marquee event in the tech industry.
Absolutely. Now, when I hear Salesforce, I've got to tell you, all I think is like just some big business that does something. I am completely out of it when it comes to what Salesforce does. And I know now, or now, or rather continually, they do a lot of things. But can you give our listeners who also might not know a sort of basic understanding of Salesforce's whole thing? What is it that Salesforce does?
Yeah, and you'd be forgiven for not knowing. I mean, they do so many things, but their sort of bread and butter was being a customer relationship management system or CRM system. So if you think about when you call into a company and you're calling, you know, a customer service agent and they're keeping your data as a customer in the system, that's what they're doing. They're sort of storing all of those inputs and those interactions. And so now they've expanded to just being from customer service and sales through to marketing and commerce, anything that sort of interfaces with the customer, they are like the backend system powering all of that.
Ah, oh, wow. For the first time, I understand what Salesforce is. I'm so glad. This is, selfishly, this is why I'm so glad you're here. I could finally get it. But now, as I mentioned kind of at the top there, it has been a while since the last in-person sort of fully kitted out Dreamforce. So with that in mind, we've seen some companies who kind of, it's our first time back, so we're bringing in, I don't know, parakeets and pelicans and fireworks. Did they go big this year, or was it sort of a return to normalcy? Was it scaled down? Kind of how was Dreamforce this year? Apparently there were fuzzy animals there.
There were fuzzy animals, but I'm told it's always there. So it was fun because it was my first year at Dreamforce and it felt huge to me. There was 40,000 people there in person in San Francisco in attendance. I think they said over 100,000 watching virtually. But just from people I talked to, it was a little bit smaller than previous years, which is hard for me to imagine. But they did go big. They had the Red Hot Chili Peppers perform during their Dreamfest on Wednesday, which was a ton of fun. They had some surprise performances from Lenny Kravitz. Matthew McConaughey was there. So, but from what I understand, they always try to make it sort of a star-studded affair. But it was a little bit smaller just from attendees I talked to than previous years.
I feel like I once again do not understand Salesforce. Matthew McConaughey was there. So I didn't originally ask you this, but I am now very curious. You said 40,000 people in attendance or around about that, and maybe even up to 100,000 or more people tuning in. Who is this for? These like business is every single one of these persons is every single one of the people in attendance a business person who has their own company? I mean, who goes to Dreamforce and who's tuning in to watch Dreamforce? Now, this is almost on the level of an Apple event or a Google event with new products being announced.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mix. And I think just by virtue of Salesforce's size in the industry, you'll have, of course, Salesforce employees and Salesforce, you know, public relations and all those people. You'll have journalists like myself in attendance. There were investors and analysts. Yes, you probably have people who have started their own business as well. Customers of Salesforce who are using their technology, whether that's a you know, medium-sized business all the way to a Fortune 500 company. So it really brings together everyone from across tech, because Salesforce in many ways sets the agenda for where the market and the industry is going. And so everyone's sort of tuning in and watching what they do and what that says about the state of the industry. So it's a very broad event. And then I'm sure some people in San Francisco who just want to stop by as well.
Yeah, I mean, if you know there's going to be a concert there and maybe some freebies getting passed out, I think if I was in San Francisco at the time, I'd stop in and see what was going on. So one of the, of course, part of this is that they are announcing new products or new services or new softwares as a service. So tell us about one of the big announcements called Genie that was announced at this year's Dreamforce.
Yeah, so Genie is essentially a customer data platform. Companies from Adobe and SAP and Oracle all have some form of it. But really what it is this underlying data infrastructure to sort of capture all the information about their customers. So as I was saying earlier, if you're making a call to customer service or you're talking with a sales agent, every time you're having a conversation, there's data and there's information. And so the customer data platform helps to take all that information and put it together. So they could look at it and say, okay, this is Aisha. She's called us to deal with a product issue 3 months ago. She purchased a new product on this day. And what that allows is much more personalized service. So for them, it's a pretty big announcement. They've had it in different shapes and forms over the years. But this one they're really announcing is sort of underlying all of their different products and just collecting and putting all that data in one place.
Well, that was kind of going to be my next question. Maybe you could provide a little more insight on how this differs from what was in place before. Is it more just, Genie is now the name and the sort of guideline for all of the systems, and they're just now kind of, locking them all together? Or is there, more and bigger technology at play underneath, and slowly the different offerings will be migrated to it? Because I think of Adobe and the sort of Sensei platform that they always talk about, where Sensei is the AI platform that underpins a lot of the technologies, but it wasn't sort of a group name for technology that already existed. Instead, it was we're going to slowly start to make it so that Photoshop features will use Sensei, and we have these other applications that will use Sensei. So is this more, again, a re-terming of things that already existed to give everything sort of an umbrella name of Genie, or is this, new technology? And if it is new technology, do we have any sort of timeline on the rollout of this this faster, better, real-time CRM?
Yeah, so a big part of it, I think, is putting a name to it and putting branding behind it. And because they assigned a character to it. So all their different products have characters. And so Genie is this bunny that wears like a purple robe, right? And so part of it is, I think, a branding and marketing aspect of it. Salesforce will tell you that it's bringing together all the data in a new way. Like they sort of had all the data existing, and they kind of had tried to do a CDP-like product in the past. But I think this is like more of a full-fledged attempt to really execute on that vision that they had. And then in terms of it being net new, I think it just sounds like it's a little bit better than it's been in the past. And they're hoping that it can start adding things like AI and analytics, and it'll be better set up to do that. But really a lot of the sort of investor and analyst community and people in tech are just sort of waiting to see, like, how new will this be? How well will it work? And then I don't know what they're thinking in terms of when it'll be generally available. And so it's sort of a wait and see moment in the industry.
Yeah, you mentioned in your piece about Genie in particular, the concerns of GDPR, CCPA, and now with companies like Apple and even Google to some extent helping individual users to stop tracking across different apps and sort of make applications be more transparent about when they are tracking, that this is in part a response to that. And so maybe if you can, a quick explanation of why this makes sense as a means of collecting data. Was Salesforce maybe in the past using other platforms to collect some of that data and just bringing it all in? Or is Salesforce kind of always focused on its own data gathering and storage solutions?
Yeah, so because Salesforce has this DNA of being this customer relationship management system, they already had a ton of customer data that people were putting in there. I think where the CDP takes another step is starting to pull more data from other places, whether it's another data company like Snowflake, or it's pulling data from the web or from social media. And so there's been a big movement towards customer data platforms in the industry because of the impending death of third-party cookies. So I, as a company, couldn't go and buy data from Google anymore. I have to collect that data by myself from an individual customer. So if a customer is coming to my website, I have to have a way to collect that data for myself rather than purchasing that data from someone else. And that's just more of a privacy concern. And so that's what we're calling first party data, data that a company actually collects for themselves. And so the customer data platforms are a way of doing that. Because if you think about how much data is floating around in the internet and social media and all these different channels, capturing all that, collecting it, organizing it is a massive task, which is why companies would sort of buy it from other places. And so now they're having to build the infrastructure and the capability to collect all that data themselves.
That makes sense. And then I think something that was a big trend, I'm not surprised, and I think, too, some people might not realize this, but Slack was acquired by Salesforce and is a Salesforce product now. One of the big announcements at Salesforce was Slack Canvas. Can you tell us about Slack Canvas and what in the world it is setting out to do?
Yeah, Slack Canvas is essentially a way to, they describe it as this persistent layer. So if you go into Slack, it'll show up almost as like a sidebar where you could see your past conversations, you could see files that you may have shared. And so it's an easier way of organizing all of the information that gets in Slack, right? When you're in Slack and you're chatting and you're sending files, sometimes you might have to scroll all the way back up to try to find something you sent a couple months ago. Slack Canvas would be an easier way of sort of organizing and finding that information. And so it's a similar thing that it's things that Microsoft Teams is trying to do, right? Just ways of sort of organizing all the information. And then it also has more collaboration features. So being able to collaborate in a document real time in the way that you would collaborate on Google Docs, it's kind of in that same vein.
Interesting. That's fascinating. A little behind the scenes for us here at TWiT, we do use the Google Suite. And right now, both my co-host Jason and I are looking at a Google Sheets spreadsheet that we keep track of sort of the interviews that will take place in the show, et cetera, et cetera. Having all of that in one place could be very handy. And I think we see this from a lot of companies. We see, you know, Microsoft with Microsoft Teams, and Facebook has attempted this in the past. All of these companies trying to be the one ring to rule them all, if I want to use a Tolkien reference. Do you feel, and of course, this is where I have you sort of step out of the journalistic shoes for just a moment and more into the shoes of someone who's paid attention to enterprise as a whole in general. Do you feel like Slack Canvas is something that was born of the acquisition by Salesforce, which is such an enterprise-minded company? Or do you think, and again, this is all crystal ball, et cetera, that Slack would have eventually introduced something like this instead? In other words, do you think that Slack Canvas is inspired by an enterprise mindset, or is it more just a collaborative mindset? And so in that way, Slack would have done this in the end, regardless.
And you know what? I don't even have to look in my crystal ball, because we actually talked to Slack about that very thing.
Oh.
It was actually part of their plan since the beginning. So okay. Stuart Butterfield had in his original pitch deck this idea of Slack Canvas, some way to sort of have collaborative documents. So I think they would have done it eventually. I mean, that was the plan from the beginning, and they're just sort of continuing to do that. And one thing that they told us as we talked to some of their product leaders was that, yes, they are part of Salesforce, but they still are very much wanting to sort of stick to the way that that they build products. So they still have the same product vision in mind and still plan to sort of execute on the ideas that they've always had. That's what they say. I mean, of course, things change. Acquisitions are challenging. Integration is messy. But yeah, it was sort of in the plan from the very beginning.
Interesting. Well, I'm glad that you asked that. Now, for this product, for Slack Canvas, because I actually am pretty excited about this as a possibility, do we have any rollout information about this, or is it still in its early days as far as the announcement goes?
Yeah, I think it's going to be available pretty quickly. I can't remember the exact date that they may have told us, but it's not something that's going to, you know, take 6 months. So it should be generally available pretty soon from what I was understanding.
Oh, that's exciting. And then last but not least, anything else exciting from this year's Dreamforce? Even if it is just, I don't know, they had very good kebabs this year.
You know, I will say it's an experience. I would just say if you haven't been, you kind of have to be there to understand it. Someone described it to me as Burning Man remade by Disney, if that gives you a sense of it. But a few interesting things we saw: Dreamforce themed sneakers. Someone had, you know, like Salesforce sneakers on. We saw that a couple different times. There was a therapy pig that was going around. I don't know how that works, but it was there. So just kind of it was just a wild event, wild experience. That's the only way I can describe it.
Well, Aisha, I want to thank you so much for your time today and for your expertise. Of course, folks can head over to protocol.com to check out your great work. But if they'd like to follow along with you online, is there anywhere they can go to do that?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter just at Aisha Counts.
Awesome. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Alrighty, folks, up next, surprise, surprise, Google is, you guessed it, shutting down another service. But before we get to that, and while Jason continues the sigh from now until it comes time for him to talk about his story of the week, I want to tell you who is bringing you this episode of Tech News Weekly. It's Dell Client Solutions Devices, orchestrated by the experts at CDW. The people at CDW, they get that your unique workforce has unique needs for their devices, especially as we all continue with hybrid work. It's a challenge for IT to supply devices that can meet everyone's needs everywhere they work so that they can stay connected throughout the day. Luckily, CDW can help custom configure Dell Client Solutions devices for a more personalized user experience. What this means is that your workforce gets adaptability for performance with AI-based software that learns how your team works and then optimizes workflows. And check this out. Dell Client Solutions devices have intelligent noise detection and cancellation, along with high-quality video that adjusts with your lighting. Pretty amazing, right? This fleet of devices is really great because wherever your team works, its built-in security responds to malicious attacks, providing a secure way to boost collaboration and productivity from anywhere. When it comes to seamless experiences, Dell Systems makes adaptive performance possible. CDW makes it powerful. Learn more at cdw.com/Dell Client. Thank you for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. Back from the break, and now Jason can tell us about Google shuttering a service.
Hi, Google. There you are again. There you go again, doing your Google thing. Jeez. Okay, so this is just, I mean, this is just from, you know, from the a story as old as time when it comes to Google, right? Is that they create something, people get excited about that something, people go all in on that something. Although now people are being more cautious, but, and then Google kills the thing. And then what felt like an inevitability ends up happening, right? It's the snake that eats its own tail at this point, because it's happened so many times with Google, and we can talk about that a little bit. But what am I talking about? Stadia, Google's cloud gaming service, is done. Well, not done yet. Google's basically announced that it's going to be done. It's killing it. This was introduced, if you remember, back in 2018. There had been a few rumors leading up to it then, or a few years of rumors leading up to it then. But it launched publicly November 2019. It was actually pretty cool, right? Like, you could use your Chrome browser to stream games from the cloud. All you needed was basically your Chrome browser was your game console, right? You didn't have to buy a game console. If you had a computer running Chrome, you could play top tier games. All the processing, all the magic was happening in the cloud on their servers. So what you were getting fed to your computer for gameplay was, you know, top tier graphics, everything, you know, given that your connectivity was good enough, everything was smooth. I think in the beginning, it was a little kind of rocky at the very beginnings, but I jumped into Stadia a few times after it launched here and there just to kind of see how it had progressed. And at least with my connectivity, I felt like games played smooth enough for me. Maybe I wasn't playing fighting games where you need those quick you know, those super fast reflexes and latency, any sort of latency might impact a game like that in the cloud. But any of the like slow moving kind of, you know, adventure style games, it was just fine. But, you know, we're here at this point where Google's not the only company doing cloud gaming, but they were kind of, they did kind of do what Google sometimes does. Like I'm thinking of Google Glass, right? Where they get into something maybe earlier than a lot of others do. And so the idea isn't bad. I never thought that Stadia, the idea of cloud gaming with Stadia was a bad idea. I just wasn't certain that there was going to be enough people to buy into it now, because it's so early for that type of thing. Not to mention, Google has a reputation. And I feel like on day flipping one, people were already saying, all right, we'll see how long it takes for Google before they get really bored of Google Stadia. And unfortunately, that has proven to be true. Now, there are reasons for that, right? They had announced a number of features that were really great right in the beginning. This was 2019 when they launched this. They were talking about some really cool features, being able to jump right into a game from watching gameplay on a YouTube video. That was one of the features. I thought that was really forward thinking. Like if that actually worked the way they showed it off, amazing. Crowd play, which actually promised to allow players to join YouTube creators in playing the very game that they're watching on YouTube. All of it had to do with integration with YouTube, by the way. State share allowed for people to share playable segments of a game for easy access direct from a video. So like I'm watching a video on this particular level and I could just boop, and it would, all it needs to do to launch that, right? It's not a console, it's just a Chrome browser. So it opens up a new tab and boom, inside of Chrome, you're playing that game from that point. These things felt different and they felt kind of interesting and forward thinking, but it still all depends on people having enough faith in the platform to actually buy into it in the first place. At the end of the day, there weren't enough people willing to do that. And part of the reason for that is because those marquee features just took too long. Like they announced them 2019 as like, these are the things that are going to make you want Stadia. And then you waited 2 years for it to happen. And by the time that had happened, other players were already doing cloud gaming. Google was kind of already proving once again that like, sometimes Google makes these big promises to get you really excited and then doesn't quite deliver. And here we are 2 years later, finally got those features. But, you know, at that point, some of the people who really would have benefited, really would have bought into it, you know, they've moved on. The game development arms that Google owned, its internal game development arms for Stadia in 2021, just last year, they announced they were going to shut down those first party game studios. That, I, you know, when that happened, I was like, all right, that's a huge signal. Like Stadia is done. Like it's toast, because all that signals, like I get it, it's about saving money. You know, it's okay, this isn't making us money, this doesn't make sense long term. But all that signals to the person who's buying a copy of a game that exists only on a cloud, you know, online, and there's no physicality to this, all you're telling them is we have so little faith in this thing that you're putting your money into that we are going to shut down the teams who have been working for however many years to create original content for this and make it even better than it already is. I have to imagine anyone who was on the fence at that point was just like, okay, yeah, I don't know that it makes any sense going there. It's just disappointing. I think where my, and not disappointing because like I'm a huge Stadia user, and sure, right, and right. people will come at me on Twitter sometimes when I voice my opinion on Stadia and be like, well, you hardly play Stadia, so who are you to judge, and blah, blah, blah. Maybe that's true. But I think what really gets me about this is that I believe that Google has a big, big problem. And that is that it's not that they get rid of things that don't work. It's not that they get rid of things that don't make money, because that's smart business. Other companies do that. The problem is they've done it in such a way for so long that now that's part of their identity. And so anyone who might consider buying into a Google service, a Google product, whatever. There's always that funny meme, that funny joke on the tail end of it, which is, yeah, as long as Google cares about it, and you know, you never know what's going to happen there. And actually, a lot of people believe that they do know what's going to happen there. Google's going to not care about it, and they're going to do what they just did with Stadia. So I'm not saying that they got rid of it for a bad reason. If it wasn't making money, great, get rid of the things that don't make money, but you got to work really hard to like fix your reputation, because at this point you're losing even Google fans, even people who are fanboying over the things that Google does, you know, have this like reluctance to it, because time and time again they prove that this is just part of their brand identity, and that's a bad thing to be part of your brand identity.
And I think part of the problem, too, is there's so much that is Google/Alphabet. If, you know, of course, inevitably the comparison is going to come up, but I'm drawing this comparison for a very specific reason. And that is because this is another large company who also makes smartphone operating systems. And so when I look at Apple and I look at Google, Apple's focus is much more pinpointed. And yes, they've started to launch some new services, but for the most part, like you can go to apple.com and see in the navigation bar at the top what Apple focuses on, all of the products that are there, and that's it. Because Google is so big and there are so many different parts of Google, you know, Google Cloud, YouTube, Google Search, Google Ads, Google, all of the analytics and because there's so much that's Google, and then they've got, you know, their hardware line, and then they had Stadia. So in and of itself, if these companies, if these groups that were underneath Google were all their own companies, then maybe it wouldn't be as glaring that this gets shut down and this gets shut down and this gets shut down and this gets shut down. But because Google has such a wide focus of things and it's all Google, then, you know, individually, these companies are going to, quote unquote, kill their darlings when they need to. But it just, as you said, you know, the reputation there, it looks bad from that macro vantage point. And so that part is so true in the sense that they have to really figure out how to repair, I think, that portion of their of their reputation. And I don't know how one does that other than keeping around stuff that they may not want to keep around anymore. Would the better idea, Jason, not be just maybe don't launch as much stuff? You know, maybe keep it in private for a lot longer? Because Amazon doesn't necessarily have... I'm not even going to say necessarily. Amazon does not have a reputation for killing a lot of things, but Amazon tries a bunch of different stuff, but they do it in this way where it's like, this is, you know, an exclusive group gets to try this out. You can sign up to be part of this, and then they roll these things out. And then if they don't like them, then, or they don't work out or what have you, then they get rid of them. And there isn't as much of that, mindset. So I wonder if it's, maybe they launch too much stuff that they get excited about being out there and actually, you know, touching the public, versus if they would kind of keep it, oh, no, we're just going to hold on to this for a little while longer before we decide if this is going to be a thing. Because
I feel like that's the Apple playbook, right?
Yes.
The Apple playbook is we hold on to it for a lot longer than others do because we want to be certain that when we launch this. And I think generally that works pretty well for Apple. I think that that's a strategy that's worked really well for Apple. It is an interesting comparison between Amazon and Google because to a certain degree, you're right. They kind of have a similar ethos where they will release a product or a service or something like that to see how it's going to do. And it's, you know, this has been largely part of Google's identity forever is like, you're a beta tester. If you're a user of Google products, you're a beta tester of Google products. And that was really endearing for a long time. And then I think at a certain point, maybe that kind of wears off a little bit. And it's like, okay, yeah, but what we really want is for you to be serious about this. And so it's an interesting question. I do have to give Google some credit though. So the official date for shutdown is January 18th, 2023. So that's a few months away. Google is going to refund all purchases, hardware, games, in-app purchases, everything. So not only are they shutting it down, they're taking a huge loss on all this stuff. And I'm really happy that they're doing that.
Honestly,
because
yes.
from day one, I was like, gosh, you know, I don't know if this is just, you know, get off my lawn thinking, but it's really hard for me to be okay with spending full price on a game that I don't own beyond the time that Google is interested in this. You know what I mean? That's mm-hmm. what really held me from buying any games, because, and I'm not even saying that cloud gaming isn't the future. I'm sure that I'm sure that where things are heading, this is more and more going to be the case the way it is. But the idea of paying full price for a game and then not being certain that 2 years from now, I won't still own that game because the service either is or isn't in operation. Like, there's servers that are required in order to run that game. It's not like putting it on my computer and running it. That might be, you know, older guy thinking as far as that's concerned, but that doesn't give me a lot of hope on spending $50, $60, $70 on a game if that really only gives me a 2 year license before it goes away. So knowing that Google's actually giving a refund on all this stuff, really great move. I think that's the only way that they could do that without getting totally and completely, you know,
one update. According to a Stadia user, Stadia Pro subscriptions are not included in that refund. I don't understand why that would be.
Oh, okay. So the subscription cost.
Oh, I guess that makes sense. That'd be a lot
of money. That kind
of
makes sense to me. Yeah, I mean,
you every month that you paid for it, you were meant to be using it that month,
right?
Versus
right.
the hardware. Yeah, so I mean,
if Netflix went away, I wouldn't expect Netflix to like refund
me for my
subscription
for all of the money I've ever spent on it. Yeah, because I was using it during that time. Maybe if you had gotten a Stadia or Stadia account and you never used it, and you could, you know, reach out to support and say, "Hey, I never used this."
Yeah,
then maybe that's something else. But yeah, I have to say. Overall, because I was going to make the argument, actually, you know, at least when Gmail was a beta, you know, you weren't making a money investment in it. And so it mm-hmm. was not something that you're paying for. So if they while you were beta testing it, like, you got that service for free. But this was going to be different until you said, hey, they're refunding people. So I actually do feel pretty good about that. And this is my like semi-annual reminder that Amazon's Luna is out there and it's actually quite good. And I'm not a huge gamer, but I really got into Assassin's Creed and played it using Amazon's Luna, and it's still around, and they continue to make good deals with different companies and release all sorts of stuff in the library. And so I just want to give them a shout out. Not mm-hmm. a sponsor or anything like that. I just think that if Stadia people are looking for somewhere to go, Amazon's Luna is one of those options. And I have found it to be quite good.
Nice. There's that. There's GeForce Now. There's Xbox Game Pass Ultimate. Logitech just announced Logitech G Cloud. I think it's a handheld device that is all about cloud streaming gaming. So yeah, there's others doing this. Yeah, and it's not even to say that Stadia was bad technology. Like, it was pretty cool what Google was able to create. It's a shame that even when they tried to white label it, you know, they were like, okay, well, if this isn't working for individual users, maybe this is technology that we can sell to others or rent to others or whatever. AT&T did this where they used it for one of their for some game promo or whatever. And yeah, I don't know. Maybe Google will continue. Was it Assassin's Creed?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know if they're going to continue exploring that path, but it's just kind of a shame to create all that technology and that whole system, and then we're done. But hey, that's business. I guess it's business. It's just it's a pattern. That's all I'm saying. So, all right. Well, coming up, Micah is going to talk about the hacker or a hacker or hackers who set their eyes on Fast Company. This is really interesting. So he's going to talk about that here in a moment. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Blue Land. Did you know that an estimated 5 billion plastic hand soap and cleaning bottles are thrown away each year? 5 billion every single year. And if that's not bad enough, most cleaning formulas are 90% water. So that makes them really heavy to ship. It's just not good for the planet. That leads to excessive carbon emissions. Plus, those products are often filled with nasty ingredients, things like chlorine, ammonia. Lose-lose situation for you and especially for the planet. If you feel overwhelmed by the number of plastic bottles and containers that you're throwing away, I know I do. We are always trying to cut down on this stuff. If you've ever thought about purchasing more eco-friendly products, but you didn't know where to start, or maybe you found some green products, but you found them to be too pricey or kind of ineffective. Sometimes we think of, you know, the alternatives of being like, eh, it's not quite as good as the other solution. Well, let me tell you, Blue Land is what you need to check out, because you're going to find everything you want here when it comes to eliminating plastic but still getting high-quality product. Blue Land is on a mission to eliminate single-use plastics by reinventing home essentials that are good for you and the planet. Blue Land's innovative tablet refill solution takes up 10 times less space than a traditional bottle, and their powerful formulas keep your home clean, keep it smelling amazing. The scents are just wonderful with Blue Land's products. And the idea is really simple. You grab one of their beautiful forever bottles. These are bottles, you know, either, you know, be it hand soap dispensers or like a house cleaning spray. These bottles are meant to last. They're not cheap, flimsy, thin plastic. You know, actually the hand soap dispenser that I'm looking at on the other side of my room right now, it's glass. And yeah, they're high quality. They're meant to be reused, and you find you just drop a tablet in there, fill it with some warm water, and you get to cleaning or you get to washing your hands. Refills only start at only $2. So $2 for a refill for one of those little tabs, drop it in and you've got a whole lot of cleaning ahead of you with that product. You don't have to buy a new plastic bottle every time you run out. That's the point. You can even set up a subscription so you never run out of the products you use most. And you save even more when you buy in bulk. And you know you're going to use them in the long term. So you might as well. From cleaning sprays to hand soap to toilet cleaner and laundry tablets, all Blue Land products are made with ingredients that you can feel good about. I already told you, we've got Blue Land products throughout our house. We actually have had Blue Land products since before they were a sponsor on Twit. My wife discovered them, and we have loved them. So it was awesome to see them come on as a sponsor for the network. It's like, that's easy. I can talk about that. I enjoy their products every day. Try their Clean Essentials kit. It has everything you need to get started. Blue Land products come in refreshing signature scents. You're going to love the scents. Iris agave, fresh lemon, eucalyptus mint. Also, they have limited edition, like limited time scents. Their hand soap is getting a fall upgrade right now with three refreshing new scents: apple butter, vanilla chai, and maple pumpkin. So check it out for yourself. You're going to love their products. And we're right on the heels of the holidays, so it's a really great gift. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order when you go to blueland.com/TNW. That's 15% off your first order of any Blue Land products at blueland.com/TNW. Check it out. You're going to love Blue Land's products. I guarantee it. It's just too awesome to not love. blueland.com/TNW. We thank them for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right. Tell us about the Fast Company hacker, Micah.
Yeah. So this is, some of you may already know about this. If you are an Apple News user and you have push notifications turned on, and you have push notifications turned on for Fast Company, then you may have seen a Fast Company push go out to you. And it also went out to many, many others that included a racial slur and sort of overall vile push notification. And you may have been going, what in the world has happened? And it turned out that Fast Company was hacked. And so this was some sort of online hack, a Fast Company, where an individual, as far as we know, was able to access Fast Company's CMS, that's the content management system, and use that to be able to trigger a push notification for Apple News. As Vice's Joseph Cox reached out on a site where the hacker, who goes by Thrax, had posted information about this Fast Company hack, reached out and was able to interview this hacker. And the hacker said, quote, "It's not every day that you get to click a button and send tens of thousands of people a notification straight to their phone. I don't know the statistic for this, but it was lots given what we've seen." Now, typically what happens whenever these hacks take place is that the hacker or hacking group will collect data and will then post it to data sharing websites or data trading websites where you can buy data or trade, you know, one bit of hacked data for another. And so that's what happened here. The hacker claims to have gotten some account logins with hashed passwords. So those passwords are not incredibly useful, but also, at least at first, claimed that they had gotten a bunch of drafts and scheduled posts for Fast Company. So that, you know, those would be upcoming and eventual stories that Fast Company would be or may have already written. Fast Company's writers may have already written. Of note, the person who hacked the website said that they wanted to embarrass Fast Company, that it could have been, and I'm doing another quote here, "It could have been a hoax threat to life event, a hoax nuclear fallout, the hoax death of President Biden, a crypto scam, or anything else which could have had the potential to shift markets. Instead, I chose to embarrass Fast Company." So what the person is saying is, you know, whenever whenever Joseph Cox asked, like, why did you do this racial slur notification, the hacker said their intent was to embarrass the company because the company did not do, according to, again, the hacker Thrax, did not do a good job of protecting itself, and claims to have gotten the login credentials off of one of these websites, these data sharing websites. Along with posting the notification, the many of the articles on the website were actually changed so that they had a similar message as the one that was sent over push. And what's interesting is that if you go to Fast Company right now, the website is still down. So this was updated on September 29th, but the hack, I believe, took place yesterday. The push notification, I believe, went out yesterday as we're recording this. And yes, Fast Company is still not up, not available for you to visit. And while they're working on sort of making sure that the site is secure and sort of seeing the extent of the damage that was done, they just push people to LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok for, you know, keeping up with what Fast Company is doing in the meantime. Now, the information, again, that was available to let this hacker do this, it's unclear how long that data was out there, but the hacker Thrax said that was not only Fast Company, but many other websites whose credentials were allegedly available in a way that, you know, Thrax was able to gain access to it. And what Thrax says too, and I find this part interesting, another quote, "I want to add that this was completely preventable. Anyone could have done it, and that anyone just ended up being me. It wasn't a sophisticated cyber attack from a foreign state, and it didn't require specialist skills." Because again, according to the alleged hacker, they just went to the proper website, probably you know, via the Onion browser, and was able to find just the credentials that were published online. So this becomes one of those moments where, I mean, and before I actually get into that, I want to say too, the I think the biggest issue here, if I was Fast Company, I would be concerned about, you're not only, you know, if it was Fast Company's website, that's one thing. Fast Company is dealing with that internally. But this hacker used the mechanism of Apple's push notification in the Apple News app. So now it's both Fast Company and Apple who are affected by this. And I don't know if folks remember or know this, but Apple is one of the most valuable companies in the entire world. And so I would not be surprised. You may have heard that before. Yeah, I would not be surprised if the full force of Apple's, you know, forensics investigation team is set to help Fast Company in figuring out what happened, how it happened, and potentially tracking down the person who did this thing. So I would be shaking and quaking in my boots personally if I was Thrax, if Thrax is truly the one who did the hack. But in any case, this was, I think, and I hope it serves as an eye-opening moment for any news publication or anyone who has access to people's phones in such a way that, you know, and this isn't speaking specifically to how Fast Company was doing it, but if you're storing passwords in like a Google Doc or something like that, or on the website, you've got a secret URL that has logins, or you're trying to simplify those processes in some way, you are doing your users and readers and listeners a huge disservice, and you're doing your own company a huge disservice. Things need to be protected to the full extent that you can so that stuff like this doesn't happen. The fact that Fast Company was one of several sites listed on this data sharing website is not great. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see or hear about a few more of these over the coming days. As you know, Thrax potentially makes use of the information that they got.
Crazy that Fast Company is still down. Like,
yeah,
that's a big impact right there. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, and I mean that's money lost. You know what I mean?
That, yeah, absolutely.
I do have a content blocker on, so I don't know for sure. But I'm going to go to that page and I'll do it in a browser that I don't have a content blocker for, so that I can see if it is if ads show on that page. Because if there aren't any ads,
I'd be surprised.
Then that means that they're not making, you know. Yeah, I don't see any.
Yeah. That would be surprising if they had an ad on that page, but yeah. Yeah, that's pretty crazy. I mean, the reality is, like this Thrax person said, you know, any person who either has technical knowledge, obviously, or even doesn't, just knows how to use a particular tool, can do a lot of damage if they really are, you know, interested in figuring that out. There's not a whole lot to figure out on some of these things. And I don't know that personally, but just know that through reading stories and like, this is not abnormal that someone's like, oh yeah, actually the tool they used was pretty, you know, it's pretty easy to find that information. It's just, it's the person / people / team creating the site, creating the tool, overlooking something obvious in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. And
I also
end up here. Yeah.
I learned that Fast Company, at least according to Thrax, so could be inaccurate, uses WordPress as the content management system behind the scenes. So,
and then I can now hear Steve Gibson Security same. Now railing on
another WordPress hack.
Yeah, there you go. You had
it's
to
about
see it
time
coming.
We get rid of WordPress. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, that's crazy. And sadly, not the only time we're going to hear about that. But sending out that reprehensible.
I think that you could have done something. You could have done anything. You could have
totally. I totally agree. Right.
you know, oh goodness, I'm going to say it. Snape killed Dumbledore, and that would have been enough. I'm sorry, if you haven't seen those films or read those books by now, then, you know.
Spoilers!
Yeah, there it is. But that would be, you know, something that would make people look twice and go, what the heck? You didn't have to go and do what you did.
No, totally.
The way that it's kind of explained, you know, that part annoyed me because, you know, the way the Thrax was like, well, I could have done this or this. All I did was this. And it's almost like they're implying that that causes no harm. But the fact is,
yeah, obviously harm, so. No awareness. Yeah. And it feels stupid to say this, but if you hadn't gone there, like, so many security professionals were discovered because they did stupid stuff like this. And then, you know, they paid their dues, they paid their time, and then they end up getting, you know, a crazy security job behind the scenes because the people, you know, running companies go, okay, well, if that person knows that or understands that and was able to see that and no one else was, we want that person on our team protecting our security. So it feels kind of stupid to say it, but it's like, if you hadn't done that particular thing, you never know. You might have had something on the other side of all this, but not when you go that route, you definitely don't. So not a good look.
Not a good look. There it is.
Not a good look. All right. Well, we have reached the end of this episode of Tech News Weekly. Always enjoy doing this show with you, Micah, and always enjoy bringing y'all some really great interviews, which I feel like we had on today's show. Tech News Weekly publishes every Thursday at twit.tv/TNW. You go there, you can subscribe to the show in audio and video formats, and that's really all you need to know, twit.tv/TNW.
By the way, if you would like to get an uninterrupted experience, we've got a way for you to do that. It's called Club Twit. For $7 a month or $84 a year, you can join the club at twit.tv/clubtwit. When you join the club, you get every single one of our shows ad-free. You get these nice little personalized feeds that has all the shows in there, so you can pick and choose which ones you want. You get access to the Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else, behind the scenes, after the show, before the show, outtakes, and more special content. And you get access to the members only Discord server, the place where you can go to chat with your fellow Club Twit members and those of us here at Twit. It's a great place to hang out and nerd out with your fellow Club Twit members. Again, $7 a month, $84 a year. And we keep adding on awesome stuff, including the Untitled Linux Show, the Hands-On Mac program, that is my show all about Apple's devices. I'll have an episode out later today talking about how to change default opening applications on your Mac, but also just using Get Info to find out all sorts of stuff about the files you're using. And Hands-On Windows from Paul Thurrott, which is your show for Windows tips and tricks. It's just, the value continues to grow, but the price stays the same. So check it out. $7 a month, $84 a year. twit.tv/clubtwit. If you want to follow me online or check out my work, you can head to chihuahua.coffee. That's chihuahua.coffee, where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. Or if you can spell my name, you can just find at Micah Sargent on many a social media network. I am available. Wait. Not available. I publish shows every Thursday, Hands-On Mac, if you are a subscriber. On Saturdays, I do the Tech Guy Radio Show with Leo Laporte, where we take your tech questions and answer them. And then on Tuesdays, I host a show called iOS Today with Rosemary Orchard, where we talk about iOS, iPadOS, watchOS, HomePodOS, etc. A lot of fun there. Jason Howell, what about you?
Well, you can find me at Jason Howell on Twitter, doing All About Android every Tuesday at twit.tv/AAA, where we talk about Android and all of it. That's why we called it that. Big thanks to John Ashley in the studio. Thanks to Burke, all back at the studio, helping us do the show each and every day. And thanks to you. That's right, you, for watching and listening. We will be back next Thursday with another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, but your game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. You already knew all that. What you may not know is that Twit now has a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the ClubTwit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the ClubTwit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a ClubTwit member yet? We'll go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up. Hope to see you there.